Thank you for joining me. I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to this week's Torah portion from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown. This message is brought to you by themessianicmessage.com. themessianicmessage.com. I hope that you enjoy this teaching. This week's Torah portion is called Vayeki, and He Lived. It is Genesis chapter 47, verse 28, to Genesis 50, verse 26. The Haftarah is 1 Kings chapter 2, verses 1 to 12, and the Brit Hadashah is 1 Peter 1, verses 3 to 9. Before we get started, let's say a word of prayer. Baruch atah Yehovah Eloheinu Melech HaOlam. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe. We thank you for your word. We praise you for your Sabbath. I ask that you just be with your people all over the earth who are keeping the Sabbath and bless them with your word in Yeshua's name. Amen. All right, this is kind of a strange Torah portion because it starts out with Jacob living and ends with Jacob dying. Let's start at verse 28. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years, so the whole age of Jacob was 147 years. And the time drew near that Israel must die. And he called his son Joseph and said to him, "If now I have found grace in your sight, put, I pray you, your hand under my thigh, and deal kindly and truly with me. Bury me not, I pray you, in Egypt." The strange thing about the first two verses, Genesis 47, verses 28 and 29, is that verse 28 refers to Jacob. Verse 29 refers to Israel dying. It refers to Jacob living and Israel dying. Now, that to me is pretty strange because generally when it mentions Israel, in the context of these Torah portions about Joseph and Jacob, Israel has something to do with the kingdom. Jacob is generally just about the man. So what are we being told here? Well, we're being told that Jacob's life parallels the life of Israel. So there is coming a time when Israel will die. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, I mean two things. One is that the current political state of Israel must die. It has to die in order for the true kingdom, the nation of Israel, the greater Israel that we're expecting being ruled over by Messiah, to come. If the current political state does not die, then the kingdom of Israel cannot come. See, we have a political state of Israel and we have a kingdom of Israel. We need the political state of Israel to be no more so that the kingdom of Israel can come and can now be on the earth. But not only that, all of the people of Israel must die. Now, that's a little bit of a quandary for us to understand because how is it that all the people of Israel will have to die? Well, we all either have to die and be resurrected or we have to die and be instantly changed. You know, Paul talks about how that in the twinkling of an eye, we will be changed. Well, that transformative instant is actually a death because flesh cannot enter the kingdom. Therefore, when, and hopefully I will be alive for this, but those people who are alive at that moment, literally, they will be dying and resurrecting instantaneously. It won't seem like anything probably to them, but their flesh will be dead and they will now be able to inherit the kingdom of Israel because the political state of Israel and all of the inhabitants of Israel globally will have died and been changed, or they will have been resurrected into the new kingdom. Verse 30. But I will lie with my fathers, and you shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burying place. And he said, I will do as you have said. That's Joseph is answering Jacob. And he said, that's Jacob, swear to me. And he, Joseph, swore to him, and Israel bowed himself upon the bed's head. Did you ever consider that it's actually going to fall on Joseph to deliver Israel to the kingdom. Now, we know that Judah has a special part to play in the kingdom. Judah brought us the Messiah. He preserved the Torah. But in the end, it will be Joseph who has to come out of exile, and he has to bring Jacob's bones with him. See, the Jews are not in exile in the same way that the house of Joseph is. The Jews are in a diaspora that they know that they're in exile. They know they're in the diaspora, but they have their identity. Joseph at this point, though, does not have his identity yet. And it's going to be incumbent on him to figure out his identity and then to bring Jacob's bones out of Egypt, out of the exile, and into the land. Now, yes, there are people among Joseph who are Jews, and they don't know that they are Jewish. I believe that I am among those people based on the genealogies that I've done. But still, the person that brings Jacob's bones out of Egypt, out of exile, is Joseph. So Jacob has to be buried in Israel. Otherwise, he cannot claim his inheritance. The inheritance cannot be claimed for Judah or Joseph, the house of Judah or the house of Joseph, unless Jacob's bones are brought back to Israel by Joseph, because you claim your inheritance by where you're buried. Jacob has to be buried in the land with Abraham and Isaac, you see, because our forefathers are listed in a three parts, okay? Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, three men, are our patriarchs. They have to occupy Israel. They have to. Bones being buried outside of Israel is the same as having been banished forever. The Lord is not going to let his people be banished forever. Jacob's bones will return to Israel, and later Joseph's bones will return to Israel. But Jacob's bones relate to the dry bones in the valley of dry bones in Ezekiel 37. We have two prophecies in Ezekiel 37. One is about the dry bones and how they come together. The other is about the two sticks. Both tell us about the restoration of the house of Jacob. And so Jacob's dry bones have to go back to Israel. So when they return back to Israel, they are no longer dry bones. They are restored. And they're not Judah's bones. They're not Joseph's bones. They are Jacob's bones, and they will live. That is the prophecy about the coming kingdom. Genesis chapter 48, verse 1. And it came to pass after these things that someone told Joseph, "Behold, your father is sick." And he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. Now, before we go past this verse, I want to just tell you that one reason, just one of the reasons I believe the U.S. represents Ephraim is because the U.S. is the younger of two nations. The U.S. is also the daughter of a nation, the daughter of Babylon. That mantle of Babylon originally referred to Europe, all of it, has been the seat of the idolatry for the house of Ephraim for the last 2,000 years almost. Okay. The U.S., though, is just like her mother. So as the EU falls, and the EU has fallen, Europe has fallen, we had World War I, World War II, and they've tried to recover EU by putting their bones together, right? They've made this European Union putting their bones together, trying to revive this thing. As Europe is falling apart, the U.S. is taking on the mother's mantle to become just like her mother. That is why I believe Europe gets the title in Revelation 17:5 as Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. Out of Europe came abominable doctrines about Yeshua, abominable practices, Christmas, Easter, so forth. And then she spawned daughters out of Europe. You think about the U.S., South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, trying to think of all of the Western nations that came out of Europe and out of that area. But the daughter is the U.S. Now, I know that in my teaching The Time to Flee, I didn't make this clear. It has only recently become clear even to me. So, you see, I'm going to clarify some things that need to be clarified from that teaching right here at this moment. Because Isaiah chapter 47 verse 1 says, "Come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon," who is the daughter and who is the mother of the daughter, you see? So, "sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon, sit on the ground, there is no throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no more be called tender and delicate." You know, there is no throne for the daughter of Babylon, and I've kind of wondered about that. Why is there no throne? Because the daughter of Babylon is not ruled over by a king. There is no throne. We don't say that the president has a throne. No, we say the president has an Oval Office. We say the president has a chair, but the Queen of England, she has a throne, you see? And so these things have started to become clearer to me since I've done the teaching, and, you know, that's perfectly normal and natural for that to happen. You see more and more things as you go along. And so she has no throne, this daughter of Babylon. But the one that is the mother gets the title of Mystery Babylon. The one that is tender and delicate, the young one, the child gets the destruction because she carries on the ways of her mother. Now, where do I get that? Well, I get it from Jeremiah chapter 50, verse 42, which is one of two chapters. Jeremiah 50 and 51 are the two chapters that deal with end time Babylon. And in Jeremiah 50, verse 42, it says, "They shall hold the bow and the lance. They are cruel and will not show mercy. Their voice shall roar like the sea, and they shall ride upon horses, everyone put in array, like a man to the battle against you, O daughter of Babylon." So end time Babylon, the one that actually gets the destruction listed in Jeremiah 50 and 51, is the daughter of Babylon. Mystery Babylon is still there. She's the mother. She gave birth to America, you see. But Jeremiah is talking about end time Babylon, and the end time Babylon is the daughter of Babylon, and it is the daughter of Babylon that goes to destruction. So I just wanted to make that clear as we come into this Genesis 48. So now here we have Jacob is getting ready to adopt Manasseh and Ephraim. Verse 2 said, "Behold, your son Joseph comes, and Israel..." Okay, so here we have prophecy. Jacob is doing something, but it's being attributed to Israel through prophecy. "And he strengthened himself and sat upon his bed." Israel is dying, and Jacob is dying. Now, again, Israel and Jacob are the same person, but there is prophecy in here. And again, the death of Jacob is being used to illustrate the coming death of Israel. And I've already explained earlier on all about that. But notice that Israel strengthened himself. So how will Israel, the political state of Israel, strengthen himself today? Well, he will do that with the blessings given by Jacob to the tribes, and with the restoration of Judah and Joseph in preparation for Israel's death and resurrection. Are you following me? The most important blessings, of course, in the list are the two that relate to Judah and Joseph. One is going to be presented to the Messiah. That's the scepter that comes through through Judah. And then the other one is going to be the royal priesthood coming through Joseph, which will be presented to the Messiah as well, that royal priesthood found in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9. And Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me, and said to me, Behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will make of you a multitude of people, and will give this land to your seed with you for an everlasting possession. So how can we know that the Lord will not let things continue as they are right now? How can we know that He will return? Well, we can know that He will return because this is a promise that He must fulfill. If He does not fulfill this promise to give this land to Jacob's seed, then He is not God. This is how we know. And I can tell you right now, sometimes it's discouraging. I get discouraged. I wonder, when are you going to return? Is it going to be in my lifetime? Yes, folks, I do have these thoughts from time to time, and I have to go and pray and ask and get reassurance from the Lord, because whether it's in my lifetime or not, we don't know. I think we're the end time generation, but we don't really know. However, I do know that the Lord has to make good on His promises. And if He does not make good on His promises, then He is not the King. He is not God, and He is not Lord, you see? So we can use this for our benefit to bolster our faith, to know that He keeps His word. Because in our own lives, we know that He has kept promises to us. If He's keeping those promises, what would make us think that He will not keep His promises about the land and about giving the land to Jacob's seed for an everlasting possession? So that is how we can know that the Lord is not going to let things continue as they are right now. Genesis 48:5. And now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, which were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you into Egypt, are mine, as Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. Now, it's interesting, we're going to find out later on that Manasseh is actually the firstborn, but even here, before the actual adoption takes place, Jacob is using Ephraim's name in the first place. And it is, by the way, these two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, U.S. and Europe, who are going to become the arrows in Judah's bow in the end of days. In Zechariah chapter 9, verse 13, it says, When I have bent Judah for me, filled the bow with Ephraim, and raised up your sons, O Zion, against your sons, O Greece, and made you as the sword of a mighty man. In Zechariah chapter 10, verse 9, And I will sow them among the people, and they shall remember me in far countries, and they shall live with their children and turn again. So we see that Ephraim becomes arrows for Judah's bows, and where are they? They've been sown among the people, but they will remember me from those far countries, and they shall live with their children and return again. So this is important for us to understand what role Ephraim and Manasseh, the U.S. and Europe, are going to have in the end of days. And when I say the U.S., I am not trying to exclude all the other nations that are considered Western nations, you know, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. I'm kind of using U.S. as an all-encompassing thing, but because the U.S. is now the head of the Babylonian beast, I refer to that as the U.S., but it includes the Western nations, and it also includes other nations, China, Indonesia, India, Russia, all the South American nations, South Africa, you know, all of the places where the children of Ephraim and Manasseh have been scattered, the children of Joseph and the children of Judah, wherever they've been scattered, they're going to be brought back. But Ephraim, the house of Ephraim, is going to be the arrows in Judah's bow against the sons of Greece. Now, Greece, if you have paid attention to other teachings of mine, Greece represents Esau. And it's interesting, talk about living Torah. This week in the news came this headline that Greece has this week voted in their parliament to recognize the Palestinian state. And a lot of the pundits, a lot of the news analysts have said that this is a particularly important thing that Greece has recognized the Palestinian state at this time. I think it's particularly important as well because Greece represents Esau rising up, and we're going to be fighting those sons of Greece, you see? And so Ephraim fills Judah's bow. And I sent out a letter that if you haven't listened to it or haven't read it, I explain more about this relationship of Judah and Ephraim coming together and how important it is for that to happen now before the great tribulation starts, or even before the altar gets built and before it gets shut down. It's very important. So please, it must be in your inbox, and if it's not, email me and I will send it to you again. Now we're going to learn about the blessings. He says again in verse 5 that Ephraim and Manasseh are mine. And what we're going to have here is a legal action. This has to be done legally and in front of all the brethren in order for it to be legal as witnesses, and there has to be this kind of court procedure. So he says here in verse 6 to Joseph, these are mine, but any children that are begotten by you after I adopt Ephraim and Manasseh shall be yours, but they shall be called after the name of their brethren in their inheritance. In other words, so if Joseph had any other children, they would still belong to the tribe of Ephraim and Manasseh, you see. In verse 7, he begins a preamble. It's important for us to understand what this preamble is. It's the beginning of an adoption process. It's a beginning of a legal process through which, if this legal process was not done, the other brothers could say that Ephraim and Manasseh do not have an inheritance. You see, so he's got to do this legally. And he says, and as for me, when I came from Padan, Rachel died by me in the land of Canaan in the way, when there was yet a little way to come to Ephrath. And I buried her there in the way of Ephrath, the same as Bethlehem. That's where Benjamin was born. Benjamin was born there. And by the way, Yeshua lived quite some time in Bethlehem, right? A little time, maybe up to 2 years. So we see here that there is a reference to Benjamin here. It's a veiled reference. It is one of the reasons why I believe that in the end of days, Benjamin is the representative of the Hebrew roots community, because he's been there in Ephrath, where he was born, and in Bethlehem. It is not a mistake that Jacob mentions this right here for not only legal reasons, but to give a hidden reference to Benjamin. So he's placing Joseph in the firstborn position by honoring Rachel, his mother. He's replacing Reuben and Simeon with Ephraim and Manasseh. They come from, these children, Ephraim and Manasseh, come from an outside land. They come from Egypt. They come from where all the other tribes, all the other brethren were born inside the boundaries of Israel, but these two were born outside the boundaries of Israel, you see? So what we have here is the first adoption of people who might be considered Gentiles. Even though Joseph is a Hebrew, his mother was a Gentile Egyptian. Now, I know that some claim that Joseph's wife was Dinah's daughter that was born after she was raped by the prince of Shechem. We don't know for sure. Nonetheless, we do know that they're considered Egyptians. Ephraim and Manasseh are Egyptians, thus they are considered Gentiles, even though their hidden lineage is Hebrew. Who else do we know in the world who think they are Gentiles and they are adopted in, but truly they are Hebrews? Probably just about 3 billion Christians, right? Genesis 48:8. And Israel beheld Joseph's sons and said, "Who are these?" Now, he had been there for 17 years. Jacob knew who Joseph's sons were, but he has to get Joseph to legally declare these sons. And notice that Joseph doesn't say, "Oh, come on, Dad, you know who these are." Yes, it says that, you know, Israel's eyes or Jacob's eyes were dim, but that's not what this is about. It's not about Israel not knowing who they are. His eyes being dim has to do with more than that, and I'll explain that in a minute. But Joseph said to his father, "These are my sons whom God has given me in this place." And he, Jacob, said, "Bring them, I pray thee, to me, and I will bless them." Now the eyes of Israel were dim for age, so that he could not see. And so Joseph brings him to his blind father, and his blind father makes a spiritual decision. Remember, his flesh can't see, but he's operating as Israel, not as Jacob, remember? So the dimness of the eyes is to make sure that we understand that this is a spiritual, this is a heavenly decision that's being made. This is beyond the realm of flesh. That's why his eyes are said to be dim here, because we need to understand that this is going beyond the fleshly desires. This is coming straight from the heavenly throne and through him. Now, by now, these boys are in their 20s. They're not little boys. And so when it says that Joseph brought them from between his knees, that's just a reference of showing that they are his children from his loins. It doesn't mean that they were hiding, you know, and then they had to crawl between his legs. No. No, it's a metaphor for that these come from my loins. And so now we're going to see that Israel makes this heavenly decision by crossing his hands to anoint Ephraim as the firstborn. Now, in verse 13, it says that Ephraim went toward Israel's left hand and Manasseh went toward Israel's right hand, which you would think that then Israel is going to reach straight out, but he didn't. He put his left hand on Manasseh's head and put his right hand on Ephraim's head. And so then he recounts in verse 16 that the angel which redeemed me from all Israel blessed the lads. Now, we know that the angel that he fought with was Yeshua, because after he was done with that fight, he said, "I have struggled with God and lived to tell the tale." So this is Yeshua that has redeemed him. It is Yeshua that redeems us. And he's asking for Yeshua to bless these lads and let my name Israel and my name Jacob and the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac be on them, and let them grow into the multitude. But Joseph, when he saw that his father had put his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it upset him, and he held up his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head. You see, Joseph doesn't understand what's going on here, and so he tries to get his father to change that way that he is blessing the two sons. But Jacob refuses. He said about Ephraim, he says, "I know, my son, I know, but he shall also become a people." I'm sorry, he was talking about Manasseh there. He says, "He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great, but his younger brother shall be greater. and his seed shall become a multitude of nations. And so we can see today how end time Babylon has seeded nations. How that we have kind of just overrun the earth. The U.S. has overrun the earth much more than Manasseh did, or, you know, what I consider Europe. You following me? So he went ahead and blessed Ephraim and Manasseh in that day, and it says, "In you shall Israel bless, saying, God make you as Ephraim and Manasseh." And he set Ephraim before Manasseh. And then it says here, "Behold, I die, but God be with you and bring you again to the land of your fathers. Moreover, I have given to you one portion above your brethren, which I took out of the hand of the Amorite with my sword and with my bow." So now we're going to look at the prophecies. And I'm not going to go through all of the prophecies, but there is a couple that I want to go through. He says, "And Jacob called to his sons and said, gather yourselves together that I may tell you what will befall you in the last days." So remember that these blessings are for the end times. These are not necessarily, they would have been developing for the last 4,000 years, you see. But in the end of times, all the things that the tribes have gone through would end up being these blessings. And so it's kind of like a child growing up. You see the traits of the child, and things might change from time to time. And as they grow, they begin to develop and they stabilize into a kind of personality trait, if you will. And so these traits describe, these blessings, or rather, are traits that describe each one of the sons. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power. Unstable as water, you shall not excel, because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. So now, let's think about this for Reuben for a minute, because if you trace Reuben like some of the scholars have, you will find that they believe that Reuben settled largely in the area of France, maybe some in Germany, some in France, and you know, there were other people there too. I mean, it's not like France is all Reuben, but they're mixed in there. And one of the things about France is, as you know, that they are, you know, the French introduced lots of immoral sexual perversions into the world. That's, you know, you know, when I was growing up, it was, you know, the French things to do, right? And I'm not going to go into more than that, but they are unstable as water. One of the things about historically about the French is that they say one thing and do something else. During the Revolutionary War, for instance, they said, "Oh yes, we'll come and help you," and then they didn't show up until the very last minute there, you know, during one of those battles. And so, you know, even now we see that they're trying to assert authority in Syria, and they say they're going to, then they don't. And then they say they're going to, and then they don't. And then they do, and they kind of do a halfway job, and they're just kind of unstable. This is typical for Reuben. Simeon and Levi are brethren. Instruments of cruelty are in their habitations. O my soul, come not thou into their secret, unto their assembly, my honor. Be not you united, for in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they digged down a wall. Cursed be their anger, for it was fierce, and their wrath, for it was cruel. I will divide them in Jacob, and scatter them in Israel." So Jacob is here telling us why they're being scattered in Israel. It's because they are cruel. Now, a lot of the men that worked on the Manhattan Project are Jewish, and many of them are believed to be Levites. and from Simeon. They have this propensity for destruction. That's why they've been absorbed into Israel. Simeon was absorbed into all of the tribes, and Levi has been absorbed into the tribe of Judah. And in fact, as we get further into the Torah portions, we're going to find out that the Levites don't even get an inheritance. The Lord is their inheritance. And so they don't get an inheritance of land. And Simeon got a small portion of land within the tribal land of Judah. But like I said, they largely became dispersed within that population. And so this has been fulfilled in the end of days. And so let's go on to Judah, chapter 8. Judah, you are he whom your brethren shall praise. Your hand shall be in the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow down before you. Now, right now in the world, Judah is out front. And we in the house of Israel are bowing to him. We are under his control. Why? Because he controls Israel. He controls the political state of Israel. We, as the house of Joseph, cannot just make Aliyah over there. We have to make Aliyah in the other area called Greater Israel. You see? Now, Judah was given the scepter. When Yeshua died, the scepter was passed to Yeshua. However, Judah still has a modicum of scepter with him. And right now, there's a struggle going on between the house of Judah and the house of Israel, because some in the house of Judah want to bring all of the house of Israel under the authority of Judah and make everyone convert to Judaism. How do I know that the scepter departed from Judah? Because in their own writings, historically, we know that in AD 30, the Roman Empire removed their right to authority in the matters of life and death. It turned out that they were not allowed to make any kind of sentencing for people who committed crime. They had to go through the Roman authority, which is why Yeshua had to go see Pilate. You see, that's why they had to go see Pilate, because Rome had the authority. It was taken out of Judah's hand. So that scepter was out of Judah's hand even before Yeshua was crucified. But Yeshua, when he resurrected, resurrected as the king. And so the scepter is still in, is in his hand. Yet Judah does remain on the earth as an authority for all 12 tribes. So this is one of the reasons why I say we need to look at what Judah says and what Judah does in their writings and get the wisdom that they have, because they've preserved the Torah for the last 2,000 years. And they have a lot of wisdom among them, but they also have the propensity for putting burdens on people. And so we want to take the wisdom and leave the burden behind, you see? So we should not be rejecting Judah as some do. In verse 9 it says, Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you are gone up. He stooped down, he couched as a lion, and as an old lion, who shall rouse him up? It says, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come, that's Messiah. And unto him, that's Shiloh or Messiah, shall the gathering of the people be. So the people get gathered to the Messiah, to Shiloh, you see, not to Judah. Again, just reiterating what I just said. However, I want to talk about this Judah being a lion. He starts out in his young life, back in that day when he's being blessed, as a lion's whelp. But he matures into an old lion, a mature lion. That word really should not be old there. It should be mature lion. And who shall rouse him up? It's like, well, you probably just don't want to mess with that lion. And in the end of days, we're seeing that this is what Judah is. He is a mature lion. He does very well against his enemies because he's mature. He knows when to jump. You know, a lion's whelp, a young lion doesn't necessarily know when to jump and when to pounce on a prey. The mature lion does. I think this is one of the reasons why the world is having such a hard time with the Jews right now, because they haven't figured out that he is a mature lion. And he's the king of the beasts, this lion, you see. And he, there's the reason why the lion is the king of the beasts. It's because he's smarter than they are. And he's stronger than they are. And he's more perceptive and intuitive than they are. See, they all attack from their flesh. But this old lion attacks from a place within. Judah has within, he has the heart of the father, you see. And that's the advantage that the old or the mature lion has at the end of days. Says here in verse 11, binding his foal to the vine and his ass's colt to the choice vine, he washed his garments in wine and his clothes in the blood of grapes. See, this is referring here, I believe, to spiritual cleansing, and it also can be referring to war, you know, the wars that he gets involved in. He washes his garments in wine and clothes in the blood of grapes, has both spiritual and physical context, and both have to do with war, right? In the spiritual life, we do war, and in the physical life, we do war as well. And it says, his eyes shall be red with wine and his teeth white with milk. And now Zebulun shall dwell at the haven of the sea, and he shall have a haven of ships, and his border shall be to Zidon. Issachar is a strong ass couching down between two burdens. And he saw that rest was good, and the land that it was pleasant, bowed his shoulder to bear, and became a servant to tribute. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Remember, this is at the end of days, and you know this is a way at the end of days here, because Dan is not listed in the tribes that become part of the 144,000. Yet we see here that Dan will be a judge. So this truly is a way end time blessing for Dan. Dan shall be a serpent by the way, an adder in the path that bites the horse heel so that his rider shall fall back. Again, this is a reference to war. Dan, even though he's not one of the 144,000, he is going to play a part in biting or, you know, going to war against the horses and their riders. Gad, a troop shall overcome him, but he shall overcome at the last. Out of Asher, his bread shall be fat, he shall yield royal dainties. Naphtali is a hind let loose, he gives goodly words. Joseph is a fruitful bough, even a fruitful bough by a well, whose branches run over the wall. The archers have sorely grieved him and shot at him and hated him. Oh, yes, they have. But his bow, or his bow, abode in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. Now, you know, we know that our shepherd came through Judah, but this is referring to Jacob, that the shepherd is coming from Jacob, from the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. And so let's not get confused here and think that the shepherd came through Joseph. It's a reference here to the mighty God of Jacob. So Jacob is the reference there. The God of Jacob is the reference there. And the shepherd is the stone of Israel. What is the stone of Israel? The stone of Israel is the one that smashes the feet of the beast, for one thing. Remember, even by the God of your father, who shall help you, and by the Almighty, who shall bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lie under, blessings of the breasts and of the womb. Now let's go down to verse 27, because I want to talk about Benjamin a little bit too. I have said in last week's Torah portion and in this week's Torah portion that I believe that Benjamin signifies the Hebrew roots or the Messianic community in the end of days. And one of the reasons that I believe that I gave you earlier, but another reason is this one right here in verse 27. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning, he devours the prey. At night, he divides the spoil. Wow. I thought we were supposed to be sheep. Well, here's the thing. If you look at the Hebrew roots community, the Messianic community, whatever you want to call us, these people that believe in Yeshua as the Messiah and they keep the commandments, these people are like ravenous wolves. We devour each other in the morning and we divide the spoil in the evening. Here's the thing about wolves. Wolves are loving animals. As long as you're on their good side, they're great. I have watched documentaries about wolves. One of the things about them is that there's a very constant hierarchy in their dens. They are loving and kind to those who are in their immediate circle, but then there can be other wolves in that den that they don't care about so much. You know, they like this one, they don't like that one. They treat this one good, they don't treat that one so good. They feed all of this over here, they feed these ones that they like real well, but they leave the scraps for the other one. And that other one better not try to get into their food while they're eating, because they'll run that one off. Okay, so that's how it is in their personal dens. But here's how it is in their relationships between themselves and other dens. When they meet up with a wolf that's from another den, there's a big fight. And so they're very controlling within their own settings. They like some, they don't like others, and they don't want to have anything to do with any other den. That describes what's happening in the Hebrew roots community. Yes, all of the tribes, all of the people are sheep, but at the end of days, they put on these attributes, they put on these traits, and they help us actually to be able to identify who is who in the world. And so these are the blessings or the prophecies that Jacob or Israel gave to his sons that they would be like this at the end of days. He gave them on his deathbed, and it said here that he charged them and said to them, I am gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the land, that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite. And it says that Jacob made an end of commanding his sons, and he gathered up his feet into the bed and yielded up the ghost and was gathered to his people. Wow. His last words were, what is going to happen to his sons in the end of days? That is a great blessing. We need to really study these blessings for the end of days, because they refer to us. Genesis chapter 50 talks to us about the remaining life of Joseph, how they buried Jacob after he died, and how that they did do what he commanded. They buried him in the field of Machpelah with Abraham and Isaac, and Joseph returned to Egypt after he buried his father and continued to reign there. He lived 110 years, it says. He saw Ephraim's children to the third generation, and he saw Manasseh's children as well. Then he said to his brethren in verse 24, I die, and God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land which he swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Joseph made the children of Israel take an oath, saying that they will carry his bones to Israel, and they did. In verse 26 it says, So Joseph died at 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. And that is the end of the Torah portion. And so, Kazakh, Kazakh, Venit Kazakh, be strong, and may you be strengthened. I hope this Torah portion has been a blessing to you. Shalom.